This talk is entitled Barbarians, Barriers and Beyond. One time when I was working at Unitarian headquarters, probably around the late 1990s, I received a letter from a freelance writer saying he was going to include a chapter about our movement in a book to be called Sects, Cults, and Alternative Religions. I was distinctly nervous about this, but I thought, if I don't cooperate, he'll just write whatever he likes. So I'd better give him the information he's looking for. And he sent me a survey with questions which I dutifully filled in and thought, I've done a good job here. The chapter on Unitarians, when it appeared, was generally very positive, painting us, in a very favourable light compared to some of the other bizarre groups that were featured in the book. Bizarre, dangerous even, perhaps. So I felt vindicated in the help I had given him. There was one teeny drawback. The first paragraph was devoted to an explanation of why Unitarians venerate Attila the Hun. I was gobsmacked, to say the least, and I rang up the author to ask what he was playing at. Oh, he said, Attila the Hun, he was one of those heretical Arian Christians. I assumed that since Arianism is closely linked to theological Unitarianism, that he must be one of your heroes. Now, Arianism is the belief that Jesus is divine but not equal to God, and it's therefore in some way a stepping stone to Unitarian ideas. In fact, Richard Price, who was the minister at Newington Green, he was a theological Arian. However, while Arianism was a belief widely held among the barbarian tribes of the period, not much is known about Attila's beliefs. So the author's claim was even more questionable, in that he was probably wrong on two counts. I had to politely and firmly request to him that he remove the offending paragraph in the next edition of the book. Fortunately, there was a next edition of the book, which he duly did. This somewhat comic episode serves to highlight the fact that image-conscious Unitarians like me get nervous about the thought that we might be associated with some notorious tribe from one of the more turbulent periods of history. Let's be honest, so-called barbarians never get a good press. We've been taught to think of the Greeks and then the Romans as the guardians of culture and civilization, and what lay outside their domain was all mud, woad, wattle and daub. I was surprised, therefore, when I watched the series presented by ex-Monty Python man Terry Jones on BBC a few years back. He made the case that the barbarians have been much maligned, that they were far more cultured and civilized than the Roman writers would have us believe, that their main weakness was simply not having a well-drilled standing army which could resist the imperialistic and aggrandizing escapades of Julius Caesar, Augustus and the like. When we think of the advent of the so-called Dark Ages, we may have a picture in our minds of a walled city surrounded by Gothic hordes intent on destruction. But so-called civilized cultures have proved themselves every bit as adept at wreaking aggression and destruction over the centuries, if not rather more so. If we just look at the history of the last 100 years, We simply can't claim that so-called advanced cultures are immune from descent into brutality. So what's really going on with all this stuff about barbarians? And what's the relevance for today? I don't claim to be sure what Constantine Cavafy's poem means in totality, but it seems to me that he might be trying to say something about fear of the other, and how human beings often have sought to bolster a kind of narrow group identity at all costs, but allowed themselves to be disempowered and duped by their leaders, and lost touch with reality in the process. Most of the picture that this poem portrays is of a society cowering before an ill-defined external threat. All the masses want to know is what the senators, the emperor, the orators, the important people, what are they going to do about this situation? There is no sense in this poem that the people themselves have any control over their own lives. They have surrendered it. But ultimately, a realization dawns at the end of the poem. Ironically, as night falls, why are the streets and squares emptying so rapidly? Everyone going home so lost in thought? Because night has fallen and the barbarians have not come. And some who have just returned from the border say, there are no barbarians any longer. And now what's going to happen to us without barbarians? They were, those people, a kind of solution. Surely we can all recognise in this description of barbarians a suggestion of all those people whom perhaps middle-class types, you and I may be, might feel uneasy about, even hostile, but who in reality have seldom, if ever, done us any direct harm at all. Asylum seekers, economic migrants, people of a different skin colour or different religion, Muslims, Jehovah's Witnesses, lesbian and gay people, adolescents, the unemployed, people living on benefits, the Roma, the Chavs, the people who are other. Whichever group of scapegoats is undesired flavour of the month, and whom those in power are often able to persuade us to blame. Besides, it distracts attention wonderfully from our own shortcomings. For too much of human history, the notion of barbarians has been, in Cavafy's words, a kind of solution, enabling an in-crowd to bolster egos, hoard wealth and privilege, and define themselves at the expense of some other group. But what an unimaginable price we have paid, and continue to pay, for propping up our puny sense of self in this divisive and ultimately dishonest way. A price paid not only in uncountable millions of lives lost in futile wars, but also the loss of personal growth and clear thinking that occurs when individuals allow their thinking and behaviour to be defined entirely by the expectations and prejudices of an unthinking peer group. It's the 21st century. Things really can't be allowed to go on like this. I was walking, doing some shopping with Mum in Caversham yesterday, and I saw a woman selling the Big Issue. And I went up to her and bought a copy and thanked her in Romanian, as you do. And In this issue, I found an interview with the historian Michael Wood, who you may well know from TV, and has just done a series on the great British story, A People's History, which I've seen a little bit of. And there's an interesting interview about the Olympics. The interviewer is asking Michael Wood to reflect on the significance of the Olympics. So this is an interview, a discussion. So the interviewer says, this is an excerpt from the interview. "The Games have boosted our national pride again. Has this been our Battle of Waterloo moment?" And Michael Wood says, "We'll know in a year's time. The Olympics showed us who we really are. I went along there and I definitely detected a fantastic boost of national self-conscious confidence and Britishness." The interviewer says, "Which has been unfashionable for a while." And Michael Wood says, "We liked the image of ourselves that we saw on the screen. We all think the athletes represent us, and they are us. There's a pride not only in sporting achievement, but in the citizenship project that we embarked upon as a nation in 1948. Immigration was a test. No other country had it on that scale before. Does Olympic success prove we're stronger as a result?" Michael Wood says, "In the 1950s, people would have been amazed by the idea that Jess Ennis was a quintessential Briton. But she is. That's the thing, and it's very interesting that that has happened in a mere 50 or 60 years. Let's look at all this at a more interpersonal level. Picture two men taking part in something akin to a strange annual ritual, mending a stone wall that divides their two properties. From what I can tell from the poem, there's no real animosity between them, but Frost is unable to shake the inherited conviction of his farmer neighbour that good fences make good neighbours. This is really another way of saying, what's yours is yours, but what's mine is definitely mine. If the two men kept livestock, one could more easily understand the reason for the re-erection and diligent maintenance of this physical boundary. But as Frost says, he is all pine and I am apple orchard. All the while, the poet is conscious that something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun. Frost struggles to articulate what this something is. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. In other words, Frost is earnestly but ham-fistedly trying to lead his neighbour to a new truth, to make a leap in understanding, but Frost is ultimately frustrated. The poet is keenly aware that the wall is quite literally against nature, a monument, a folly, you might say, to human possessiveness and stubbornness. A few months ago, I wrote a short wry verse of my own, which in no way matches the beauty and clarity of Frost's work, but perhaps echoes it or shadows it in some feeble way, and I wasn't aware of Frost's poem at that time. It's called Leylandii. Immense conifer, your shady controversy separates neighbours. We were wise enough as our green wall thrust skywards to ensure pruning. Private contentment secured by slow, varied trees needs no green-black spires. I value the shade given by trees in our back garden, but I hope that I don't see the trees as primarily a way to mark out my territory. We inherited Leylandii at the bottom of our property. They increase the privacy of the house, but we keep them trimmed, not only because they block out the evening sun for us, but we're concerned that they would obstruct morning light for our neighbours in the road behind. I prefer the ash tree, the holly and the plum tree there to the side. They give shade, but they are not dense and implacable in the way the Leylandii are. When I originally wrote this sermon, it was not long past Easter, and I invite you to think back to the drama of Holy Week this begins with Jesus' entry into that proud citadel of holiness and culture, Jerusalem, on Palm Sunday. As an Aramaic-speaking Galilean who mixed with the rough end of society, making a tumultuous entry into a city that probably had little understanding what he was all about, he must have seemed to some of the respectable citizens as a bit of a barbarian. Yet not for him a military conquest, driving the Roman occupiers from Israel. He was seeking to tear down the walls in people's hearts. He talked with prostitutes and Samaritans, simple working men, lepers and outcasts of every kind. He had no real use for walls. I invite you now to take a moment to think of all the strangers you meet in your own life in a typical week. Folk working in shops, in libraries, the garage attendant, strangers on trains, or people standing with you at the bus stop. Some of these people will be obviously very different from us, perhaps because of the colour of their skin or the way they dress. Others will be older or younger, belonging to some age group that we rarely converse with, perhaps. How would it be if each of us took a couple of minutes this week to chat to someone we meet and just listen to what they have to say? Just listen. A very modest notion, but who knows how much good it might do that person to be listened to, and how much good it might do us. When contemplating walls and divisions, I turn to another poet for some hopeful words of wisdom that each of us can put into practice in ways large or small. I'm sure many of you know this very short piece by Edwin Markham, but I make no apology for sharing it again here. Outwitted. He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in. May our lives be filled not with the fortifications of fear and mistrust, but with enabling circles of love and understanding that bring us into ever closer harmony and understanding with everyone we meet. Amen. This church is sustained by what we are able